This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. Corporate capitalism has ravaged the planet, triggering cascading environmental, economic, and social crises. Ellen LeConte explores the situation in her new book, Life Rules, Nature's Blueprint for Surviving Economic and Environmental Collapse. And she's on the phone with Thane Maynard.
Hi, Ellen. It's Thane Maynard from Cincinnati Zoo.
Hi.
You have written quite a book. You really have, because it is provocative and challenging. It's got a little common sense, but I'm sure you've gotten some response.
Oh, yes. most of it actually quite positive. Occasionally the naysayer.
It really is, you know, challenging by taking, in some ways, a swing at sort of corporate capitalism, saying we're using the world up.
Yeah, completely a swing at. I mean, basically what I'm saying is it's a pathological system, and the systems that it's doing in are human and natural communities, and doing more of the same is, in my analogy, sort of like shooting somebody up with HIV that already has AIDS.
Mm, exactly. So, yeah. But the common sense part of it is that really, as your subtitle says, nature's blueprint for surviving economic and environmental collapse, it's not that you provide just a critique, but also some solutions.
Yes, and it struck me that we needed, in the way that I felt we needed, a larger way to understand why the global economy is giving us, creating the kinds of havoc it is environmentally, economically, socially, and politically. I felt we also needed a context within which to understand what we'd have to do. Otherwise, we would choose solutions piecemeal, and that wouldn't work. We've seen what it means to try to solve problems as if they weren't related to each other. We're kind of dealing with a whole lot of that at the moment in the economic system. So it seemed to me that the largest, most successful, longest-lasting economy on this planet is not any kind of human economy, but life itself. It's the largest provider of goods and services to the most kinds of species in the most sustainable way imaginable. So I looked more closely at how living systems manage to thrive, to live within Earth's means on a finite planet. And there's a passel of stuff we can learn about how to do that and bring our own ways of living much more in harmony with our ecosystems and the planet.
The challenging thing, of course, is here in the 21st century, there's a lot of rhetoric that sounds that way, and yet maybe not a lot of action to move that way. Say, for instance, getting off of fossil fuels. I know that's a thing you refer to in the book. Golly, not a day goes by that I don't hear that, wow, people have new ways of getting more fossil fuels rather than thinking how to use less.
And this is, again, one of the things I say in the book, and another example that I took directly from how life has worked on this planet. No single species since bacteria 3 billion years ago has succeeded in globalizing an economy, in running it on one set of energy and polluting and so forth. Life has a way of ruling out species that try to do that. So the key will be relocalization and regionalization of our economic activity. My best guess is that we're not actually going to do this until we absolutely have to, until circumstances give us no choice, and certainly leadership. There's no leadership anywhere in the world, whether elected or not, that's actually going to tell us that we have to lead very different, much more local, much more self-reliant lifestyles. But there are people who are beginning to do that. Transition Towns initiatives, for example, there are communities that are creating local currencies, the slow food movement, the slow money movement. All of these are examples of communities here and around the world that are learning to proactively prepare for when energy is too expensive or not available, when the economy collapses or is providing less well, which it already is doing for many people. So there, the object would be for people preferably to prepare proactively for the kinds of crises that are coming. If we don't, we will find that we will have no choice but to do the things I suggest in the book we could do proactively.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting, though. I think sometimes things get exaggerated by whether that's political campaigns or the kind of, frankly, still political campaigns you might get from talk radio or talk TV that
yes.
likes to point fingers and say, well, gosh, you know, people interested in green initiatives are anti-jobs. And of course, that's not the case. I think everybody's interested in jobs for the future and, like you said, that can be sustained.
That's right. And interestingly enough, I mean, if you take life as an example, every single species in an ecosystem has a job. Every individual in an ecosystem has some sort of niche job that they do other than just providing for themselves. This, the fallout of the work they do helps sustain other species. Well, in the kind of, you know, more self-reliant, regionally cooperative economies that may well come or that we could choose proactively, people's skills and abilities would be far more often used than they currently are. And the level of pleasure people might take in doing work that actually provides for themselves and the people they know, and at the same time provide some sort of income or reward in bartering or in services, could be much richer than we're actually experiencing now as money becomes problematic.
So this question of how do we get people to change, right? A lot of times what folks might say in the wildlife conservation movement is that the animals or the plants aren't the problem. It's the humans and their need to figure out how to change. And obviously your entire book's based on natural systems. Give some more examples of either places you've seen that happen or case studies where you've seen that, hey, it's working great for these folks.
Well, there are several in the book. And actually, I mean, to be perfectly honest, any kind of case study ongoing in these issues now is still very much always at risk of being squashed by the larger economy or of failing to gain sufficient regional and local support. So you have to look hard to find currently operating communities that have already fully transitioned. You can find a lot of examples of communities that have begun to do one kind of thing or two or several, to reduce their carbon footprints, to produce more of their own food locally, to start to organize locally, to provide alternatives, for example, when school systems are having a hard time dealing with the number of kids they have or dealing with problem kids. There are people forming alternatives to that for kids. But you really have to go back in history in terms of change, the kind of mind shift that we're talking about that most modern humans would have to go through. Most of those sorts of mind shifts have happened in periods of crisis like the one we're in or entering. I call it a critical mass of crises.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, we change our minds when we see that making the choice to change is actually going to give us a better result than the one we're getting now. So as long as we believe an increased global economic activity, that things are going to get to be the way they were, say, 20 years ago again, so long as we believe that, we will continue to try to do the things that we did in the 1980s, the 1990s, before it came rough in this new millennium financially for a lot of people. As soon as it's clear that it isn't going to get fixed, people will begin to change their minds about what's important, what they can do for themselves, what makes for a good life, what to expect from government. But it will take, I think, the kinds of pressures that are coming that we haven't here quite recognized yet are severe enough to require us to make a major change.
In fact, I think one of the most compelling things about your book, Life Rules, is that you've made a connection, very, very clear connection, that this very same thing that is fraying the natural world and what scientists sometimes call ecosystem fatigue are the very same pressures that are fraying the world's economy and
That's
human
right.
industry. And talk about that just a little bit.
Basically, what I say is that this economy is now too big not to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it is that it's an economy. Industrialization, of course, gives us the fossil fuel process, and sufficient cheap, easy fossil fuels are becoming less and less available around the world. But the real issue is that we are burning through the support systems and the resources that actually provide us with what we really need, fresh water, good soils, forests. And systems that clean the air and balance the create the alkaline acid balance in the oceans. These are the things that allow us to live at all. And our economy, our global economy that works on increasingly funny money, operates out of the principle that it's so long as there is funny money, so long as there's money around, we can acquire what we want. Well, not if we've burned through it. And
mm-hmm.
with the limits on a finite planet to those resources and healthy ecosystems that we need, it doesn't matter how much money we have if we've destroyed them. So this is where a perpetual growth economy runs up against the actual material finiteness of this planet.
Absolutely. And you make the case beautifully in your book. I know in it you quote Tom Friedman. I don't know if you've sent a copy to him or he's reviewed it, but your book reminds me of his work, which is terrific. And the other one that it reminds me of lives near here, the poet of Kentucky, Wendell Berry. I know he would enjoy this book a great deal.
Well, I actually have had correspondence with Wendell Berry, but he no longer endorsed his books because he was deluged with too many books from people, manuscripts or whatever. But he did express some support and interest, and he has been supportive of my work in the past. So I'll have to go without his blatant endorsement. But it was he was very much on my list, and I've admired him, of course, for decades.
Absolutely. If it's good enough for Wendell, it's good enough for me. So listen.
Me too, absolutely. Throw in poet Mary Oliver for beauty, and I'm pretty well covered.
Absolutely. Well, Ellen, thanks for taking a few minutes with us. No kidding, your book is terrific.
Thank you, and life does indeed rule. We keep finding that out, and if we learn to obey those rules, we're going to be a whole lot better off, and I thank you for your work and your thoughtful questions.
My guest has been author Ellen LeConte, author of the new book, Life Rules. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Thane Maynard.